Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Cash and Carry Kitchens. We design, craft and install beautiful kitchens. cashandcarrykitchens.ie.
Email todaycb at rte.ie.
So as we've been hearing right throughout the show today, Ukraine's President Zelensky is in Washington, as are leaders from Germany, from Britain, from France, Italy, NATO and the EU. This is ahead of crunch meetings with the US President Donald Trump a little later. And all of this comes hot on the heels of Friday's Trump-Putin summit in Alaska, where the US President seemed to endorse the Russian vision of a land for peace settlement. Well, Chief Correspondent with Feature Story News, Simon Marks, is with us now. Simon, thank you for joining us today. We were speaking to the BBC's Frank Gardner a little bit earlier on. I asked him what was at stake and he said everything. Do you agree?
Oh, absolutely. I think this is going to be the most consequential transatlantic meeting since the alliance's formation, really. Certainly the most consequential meeting of the modern era, because what is perceived by European leaders with justification as Donald Trump's treachery over the weekend here has called into question the whole future of the alliance, which is why we're seeing so many European heads of government, along, of course, with Mark Rutte, NATO Secretary General, Ursula von der Leyen, the European Commission chief, racing to get here, partly to protect Volodymyr Zelensky from being on the receiving end of another mugging in the Oval Office by Donald Trump, but also because they now urgently need to try and drag Donald Trump out of Vladimir Putin's orbit. When that summit finished on Friday, the American president looked exhausted. His entourage looked shell-shocked at the end of that summit. And they all seemed to be sort of shrugging their shoulders and saying, OK, there was no deal. Everything changed over the weekend after Donald Trump in Washington played a round of golf with Steve Witkoff, his special envoy. And by the time that was over, suddenly the United States no longer was interested in negotiating a ceasefire, was instead going for full-scale peace negotiations and embracing Volodymyr Zelensky's view that Vladimir Putin's view that Volodymyr Zelensky needs to surrender the entire Donbass region to Russia, which, of course, is completely off the table for Zelensky and off the table for European governments, at least absent any kind of logical peace process with security guarantees being provided. So this is a major day that is just dawning here in Washington.
Mm-hmm. So in terms of how the day looks, and I know you've had the schedule, haven't you, from the White House, Simon. So maybe you can talk us through the choreography here. How does it all work?
Yeah, and I would just caveat this, Claire, by saying that as we saw on Friday with the summit in Alaska, these schedules that the White House put out are subject to substantial amounts of change because there's a scramble going on behind the scenes. You know, that summit was thrown together in Alaska. Today is being completely thrown together. It all kicks off at about 5 o'clock Dublin time when European leaders arrive at the White House. At around 6 o'clock Dublin time, President Trump greets President Zelensky officially. Then at 6:15 Dublin time, they go into a bilateral meeting. It seems that is a one-on-one meeting between the two of them. And the press pool will be in the Oval Office for that. So we've got to keep a very close eye on that. An hour later, the European leaders are greeted by the president. There's a family photo. That's with the European leaders around 7:30 tonight, Dublin time. And at 8 o'clock Dublin time, President Trump participates in a bilateral meeting with European leaders. So I think there will be great nervousness among those European leaders about what happens in that meeting between Zelensky and Trump, which is taking place at around 6:15 your time.
And all in full view again, pretty much all of these conversations will happen with the world watching on.
Well, it looks like certainly the Zelensky conversation is happening with the world watching on. When he meets the European leaders, that's the press pool has been invited into that as well. I mean, the ability of visiting government leaders to constrain how the White House handles these events seems to be pretty limited. And if Donald Trump decides that he wants to turn either of those meetings into the latest edition of the Trump show, they are going to have to box just as cleverly as he does. And they're going to have to push back. I mean, I don't think we can expect, you know, what we've seen before, which is Mark Rutte, the NATO Secretary General, who likes to absolutely apply baby oil constantly to Donald Trump in a bid to flatter him. This is going to be, I suspect, a much more contentious day.
Mm-hmm. Just, you know, noting the fact that the White House has accepted that, you know, these leaders are should come, and they're apparently welcome to come and attend these meetings. I mean, what does that tell us about what the White House thinks now? Is it a sign that there are some in the administration who are sympathetic to the European position and perhaps are upset about Donald Trump's apparent pivot towards President Putin of Russia?
There's very little public sign of that emanating from Donald Trump's inner circle. I mean, the only person who was vaguely trying to apply the brakes to the process on Sunday was Marco Rubio, the Secretary of State, who was sort of behaving on American television like the adult in the room, saying, hold on a second, we are not close to finalizing this peace agreement. Trump and Witkoff and the others involved in this are all embracing the notion. I mean, they haven't completely articulated this publicly, but Witkoff went right up to the line of saying yesterday that this thing today, this is the peace negotiation for Ukraine. This is the day on which it's all going to happen. And there appears to be this ongoing naivety, certainly within Donald Trump and Steve Witkoff's offices, about the pace with which you can do this. Donald Trump's impatience, especially after Friday blew up in his face, to get all this done. A week ago, he was promising European leaders that he would adhere to a 5-point strategic plan in his negotiation with Putin, that he would absolutely press for a ceasefire, and that if he didn't get one, there would be very severe consequences in the form of sanctions for Russia. By Friday night, all of that had just evaporated completely, and the European leaders realized that the pledges that Donald Trump had made to them in a virtual call last Wednesday were not only no longer operative, they had never been operative in the president's mind. So the gulf here is intellectual. Trump and Witkoff want to get the entire peace negotiation done today, and Zelensky and European leaders just look at each other and say, well, that's absolutely, completely impossible. What are these people thinking?
Mm-hmm. Now, I know in this morning we've been hearing that there has been a Russian attack on an energy facility in Ukraine in the southern area of Odessa, and that energy facility, it belongs to Azerbaijan. But President Zelensky in the last couple of minutes has been saying that Russia carried out strikes on Ukraine intentionally ahead of the Washington talks, and he's gone on to say that Russia should not be rewarded for war. So I suppose it sets the scene in some way, doesn't it, for the hours that are to come? He's saying that the Russian strikes humiliate the diplomatic efforts. Does that change anything in these hours before those meetings get underway?
I mean, I think we'll have to wait and see what kind of mood President Trump is in when they get underway. I mean, one of the issues that everyone, I think, is confronting is that Donald Trump is always hugely influenced by the last voice that he's heard. And on Friday night, the last voice that he'd heard was Vladimir Putin's. Volodymyr Zelensky said over the weekend, we can't possibly go into full peace negotiations without a ceasefire. I can't engage in peace negotiations while my country is coming under continuing attack by Vladimir Putin's. Now, whether the Europeans and Zelensky make any headway advancing that with Donald Trump is one of the many big questions that I think we'll get the answer to today. I mean, the biggest question of all is, how close are the Europeans going to have to come to threatening some kind of rupture in the transatlantic relationship? Because, you know, on the trajectory that Donald Trump was on over the weekend, if Zelensky doesn't agree to his terms, terms, he would then say to Zelensky, well, I'm not going to provide you with any more military assistance, putting the Ukrainians at a monumental disadvantage. So, you know, this is going to be, I think, a very, very bruising series of conversations today.
Now, I wanted to ask you as well, Simon, about the National Guard, the federal law enforcement agencies on the streets of Washington, D.C., where you are and you work, I know, in a building opposite, pretty much opposite the mm-hmm. White House. What changes has this brought? I mean, how visible are these forces?
Oh, well, they're definitely visible, but that's partly, Claire, because of where they are choosing to be visible. And they are, you know, we've seen armoured personnel carriers encircling the Washington Monument, you know, that big sort of Cleopatra's Needle style monument in the centre of the city, which again is just a few blocks away from our office and from the White House. There are patrols by various representatives of various government agencies. So in the downtown area, they are definitely extremely visible. Of course, they are visible largely in places where crime does not, frankly, occur in a particularly serious fashion. And the Washington Post has put together a very helpful map that shows you where these federal agents and National Guard troops are being positioned versus where the actual crime takes place in Washington, D.C., and they're rarely in the right neighborhoods. But I think the overwhelming thing to underscore here is, you know, where I work, where I live, I don't walk around on a daily basis feeling particularly unsafe. And having lived here for 32 years, I can tell you that I felt much less safe 3 decades ago than I do today, which is reflective of the fact that violent crime statistics in Washington are at a 30-year low. So while there is no question that carjackings are on the increase and that there are some places that I wouldn't really want to be seen in at 2 o'clock in the morning, you know, the U Street corridor, which is a big center of nightlife here, the Navy Yard, perhaps. By and large, we're not all walking around hunkered down and, you know, thinking we mustn't spend any time on the streets for fear of being mugged or carjacking or murdered, which was the case 30 years ago. So this is a created problem that Donald Trump has manufactured, and he's got all sorts of reasons for doing that. One is to shift Jeffrey Epstein off the front pages, and the other is because he plans to do this in Democratic-run cities all over the country to portray the Democrats as soft on crime as we hurtle towards the midterm elections in November of next year.
Simon, good to talk to you, and I'm sure we will catch up again in the coming days as all of this unfolds. Simon Marks there in Washington. Simon is chief correspondent with Feature Story News. Coming up next, Dr. David Coleman will be with us with plenty of parenting advice, and there's still time to get your questions in. The WhatsApp number 0870 32 32 32.
Text 51551 today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1.